They were three ordinary women on what seemed like a simple mission to find a film they liked. One where women got something to do and not just look pretty or be murdered. Which, to be totally honest, has complicated matters a bit. Welcome to Flicking. Yes, it sounds a bit rude. That's the joke.
Hello, dear listener. Welcome back to Flicking. We're on five. We're on episode five. And Hannah.
Hello.
And I are once again joined by our film buff, Yosra Osman. Hey, Yosra.
Hey.
Who has, as Hannah just said off air, once again brought the heat because we are all melting.
It's baking. I don't know what's happening, but every time I'm on this podcast, it's very hot.
Just to fill you in, if you've listened to episodes before, you know what we're doing. We're taking it in turns to watch our favourite films, which inexplicably meant that we watched Kindergarten Cop when we let Jen have a go. Still recovering from that. Then we watched The Station Agent, which was Hannah's pick. And last time we watched Jaws, which was my pick. And Yosra, it was your turn.
So it was very hard to pick just one film, but I decided to go for Barry Jenkins' Moonlight for this podcast. And I'm quite happy with the choice now I've watched it again.
When was the last time you saw it before you watched it again for Flicking?
Before I watched it again for Flicking, the last time will have been about a year ago, I think. Yeah, about a year ago. I've seen it now about four or five times since I first saw it at the cinema. And it's one of those films that I was worried when I first saw it and I was so like mesmerised by it. I thought, gosh, am I going to watch it again? And it's just not as good. But I have to say, every time I've seen it since the first time, I've still been quite mesmerised by it. So that's the sign of a good film, in my opinion.
Just in case someone who is listening hasn't watched it or indeed heard of it, could you tell us a little bit about the plot, please?
Sure. It's a film by the director Barry Jenkins. It's based on a semi-autobiographical play by Terrell Alvin McCraney called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And it's sort of a coming-of-age story. It's about a character called Chiron. It tells his life in three parts, three key stages in his life, once as a boy, once as a teenager, and once as an adult. And a few things happen in that time. I don't want to give too much away, but there are key things that happen in each part of his life that's played. You know, he comes from the troubled background. He's in Miami as a child. It's in the middle of the crack epidemic. His mother uses drugs. He makes friends with a local drug dealer played by Mahershala Ali. It's also an LGBTQ plus film, so the character is gay, although he doesn't know he's gay for quite some time. It's just a really beautiful story, and I think, you know, there's lots that you could kind of latch onto in it, you know, the fact that he's from a troubled background, or, you know, his mother is using drugs, or the fact that he's gay, but it doesn't really latch onto either of these things. It is a proper story of his life, and I just think it's really well told, so I'm going to recommend it quite strongly, but I'd be quite interested to know what you both think about the film.
Hannah, it was your second time watching it, wasn't it?
Yeah, as I said, I saw it on an aeroplane, so I saw it on a screen that was pretty small, and now I saw it on a screen that was bigger. I don't recall there being anything in it that I hadn't seen before, but aeroplane films are cut, and it has been a while since I've seen it, so it may have been different. But yeah, I mean, I loved it. It is well in my wheelhouse, as it were, because it reminds me, not because it's about gay men, but because it's about isolation, I think. It reminds me of two other films that I absolutely love, Brokeback Mountain and God's Own Country. Both of which are about men that have not really engaged with other people before, largely familial circumstances. So then it's not particularly that they're gay that's the point. It's the fact that they live in quite isolated circumstances. With Chiron, it's isolated circumstances because he doesn't fit in and he doesn't have a dad and he doesn't have a great relationship with his mom. And in those other films, it's actually geography that has isolated them from people. But then they meet someone who is, I think, slightly what they want to be, gregarious or whatever. And the central performances are really quiet. Like here, all three Chirons are amazing at that still quietness. It's what Heath Ledger really nailed in Brokeback Mountain. It's what Josh O'Connor really nailed in God's Own Country. So yes, it was very much in my wheelhouse. It is the sort of thing that there are points at which I thought, if I could hug my television while I was watching this, I kind of would. It's so lovely and so warm. how it manages to achieve that against the backdrop of something that is quite miserable and bleak, I think is really, really impressive.
I think that's a really good point in terms of, you know, there's a lot in the story that in other films might look exploitative, or that, you know, there's themes such as absent father, drug abuse, all this kind of thing. But there's something really, really beautiful about the film as well. Like, I remember when I first saw it at the cinema, I came out of the cinema with one of my really close friends and I said, it's like a piece of art. I didn't know how to, it's like an artwork. And yeah. I just loved it. So yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. Mickey, did you like it? Because you hadn't seen it before, had you?
I thought it was almost overwhelmingly beautiful. Before we even get to the storyline, the way that it's shot is gorgeous. I think when we watch films that are about gritty realism, which as much as it's about love and friendship, this is also about masculinity and some toxic masculinity, and about him being bullied, and about the effect that drugs have on his life because of his mum and because of Juan, they're usually shot in these kind of duller colours to make them look grittier, but this is just saturated with light and colour. And there's lots of shots of the ocean, which I'm a big fan of. And there's no fear there in just having these lingering shots of people playing or people just sat together. There's no rush to tell the story, which I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I had a cry at the end. It was really beautiful. Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was a happy ending or a really sad ending, but I certainly went away and I've thought about it since. And I think that is very telling of either a really shit film, Kindergarten Cop, or a really, really good film, is that it stays with you. And it's absolutely stayed with me.
Yeah.
It got robbed at the Oscars, though, man, right?
Well, people always remember it now as the film that the whole mishap with La La Land, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want that to be what it's remembered for, because it's just such a good film on its own. And I know a lot of people have since seen it and they also love it, but it's just, I don't know, to me it's a bit like an experience watching it. And like you said, Mickey, when it finished I just couldn't stop thinking about it for days. So it's a really good
yeah, yeah. I think the way it's shot is you're right, it's really crucial, because you get, it is shot from his point of view for the vast majority of it, and close up. People are so often shot in close-up, so it's literally you are seeing what he would see. And I think it's most effective when they do it with Naomi Harris, who plays his mum, for anyone who hasn't seen it, because she is so beautiful and she is so smiling and it's so soft focus. And I think it's really effective because it reminds you that on the one hand she is a terrible mother to him, but that's what she looks like to him because she is his mum.
Yeah.
And there is a level of, there's no right for someone to be, I mean, obviously she looks terrible at the end, but there's no right for someone to be as so wrecked on drugs as she is to appear so beautiful and appear almost angelic, except for the fact that part of what he sees will be what you are seeing at that moment, because that's his mum. And she will always be his mum, regardless of however good or bad a mother she is to him.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it's, I think there's a particular scene that I'm thinking of where I'm remembering the lighting, but she shouts a particular word at him. And I think you know which scene I mean. That is just filmed so wonderfully. Like, I remember, like, it's just a really clear scene in my mind. And there's so many things down to that. But I think for Barry Jenkins, I've got to say, like, absolutely, because he'd only done one film before this, and it just brilliant direction all round. And I don't know if you've seen his film that he did after this, If Beale Street Could Talk, but that's another
one. I have seen that, yeah.
Strongly recommend. And
yeah, it's really good.
It's brilliant. And another thing that we've not really mentioned is the score. The score is just beautiful. It's I've got it on my phone. I listen to it now still. I just think it's an absolutely stunning score by Nicholas Britell. And I can't remember if he was even nominated for anything, but just really wonderful. Sorry, just dripping with enthusiasm for this film and with sweat because it's so hot. But, you know, I think there's so many brilliant elements to it that I could just talk about for days.
I'd like to go back to, Hannah mentioned Naomi Harris, and I actually think her story arc is one of my favourites, because she gets a little bit of, I'm not sure if redemption's the right word, but she gets to be the strong character again at the end, who actually manages to stay in Chiron's life, even when he's changed. So the dramatic shift from him being little to him being Chiron, because each part of the triptych gets his nickname at the time. So he goes from little to Chiron to black. And the transformation from little to Chiron, I think, is like properly like, oh yeah, I can absolutely see that those kids look a little bit alike. But the jump from Chiron to black, where he has been in prison and he's bulked himself up and he's got those grills and, you know, he's trying to be Juan, isn't he? He's going back to the only father sort of figure that he's ever had. And I really loved his relationship with his mum then, because it felt like she was finally being able to mother him and he was allowing that.
Yeah, there's sort of that moment of redemption where they're talking at the centre and she wants to love him and she wants him as a part of her life, and it's a really stunning scene, I think.
Mm.
There's lots of moments like that in terms of the interplay with different characters. I think the relationship obviously between Chiron and Kevin, that's a really important arc through the film, and I just think the way they end it, that final shot of the two of them as well, is just so well done and well crafted. It really got me to thinking about this person and Chiron, and the fact that he is a bit lonely. You see it in the beginning. He doesn't really have any close friends. Then Kevin comes along and Kevin is his friend. And then you have that bit in the middle sequence in terms of the hazing ritual and how that affects him. And then it comes back to the end where they meet again in the restaurant. And I don't know, that it's just a really wonderful story arc. And it just feels really authentic. Everything in this film, all these relationships feel really authentic, like I really believe all the characters and their relationships and how things are for them. So as a piece of storytelling, along with all the beautiful stuff that we've talked about, the cinematography, the score, the direction, the actual story is something to me that's really believable.
Yeah.
If we step briefly outside of it as a film and look at it as sort of within the context of the history of cinema, it is undoubtedly significant as well, in that it was the first LGBT film to win Best Film. Also, you can correct me on this. In fact, you all know the facts. Do you know the facts of what it won that nothing had ever won from that perspective before?
So it was the first film with an all-black cast and the first film, LGBTQ film, to win the Oscar for Best Picture. It was an independent film with a very low budget, and I think in terms of how much it made, it's something like the second lowest amount of money. I can't remember. Yeah. Something like that. Anyway, that's not as important. But also something to give a shout out is Joy McMillan became the first black woman to ever be nominated for an editing Oscar. So there were quite a few milestones that it achieved, and it's really significant. Sometimes I look back and I think, really, that was the first one?
Yeah, shocking, isn't it? What I wanted to ask you was, you were actually on our first ever podcast.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation about black cinema in our first ever podcast, which would have been 3 years ago.
Yeah,
probably three years ago. Yeah. And you said in that you were not fed up with, because you said that there was value in 12 Years a Slave and there was value in The Help and they were good films, but that you wanted to see more films that were about black experiences that weren't about victimhood in some way, that weren't about being sort of oppressed as the key point to it. And this came along and it was like you imagined this film out. You talked about it, Yos, right? If you build it, it will come. And this film arrived. So I wanted to ask you about the context of Moonlight within black cinema. It obviously is a milestone. Do you think it has had a positive effect as it goes on?
Yeah, I do. I think that all credit to Barry Jenkins for choosing these stories. And you're right, I do remember saying that actually. It goes back to what I was saying about it being authentic as well and not exploitative. It's it's something that I think really holds true now. I mean, like I said, I've watched it now 4 or 5 times, and every time I take something different away from it. And credit to Barry Jenkins. I mean, I say it again, Beale Street Could Talk, which was his next one, is a similar kind of thing. He's telling really good stories and brilliant films that I think we should be seeing more of. Sorry, that wasn't really answering your question, but it's kind of...
It was in a lot of ways.
I think it wears its issues really lightly, and yet I came away with probably more understanding of them than if they'd sort of hit me on the head with a sledgehammer, because you're in there with the character, you know. I loved him. I wanted everything to be okay. There was a real warmth for Chiron.
It is an experience. You experience the film, or at least I did, and it doesn't need to shout out about what's going on. And I think that's a really great example. And yeah, it's funny that you say that, you know, I said all that stuff back in the first podcast, and then this film came along. I'm like, oh, maybe I should take some credit for that. But like,
yeah.
Barry Jenkins was reading my mind and thought, oh my God, Yosra Osman thought this on the Standard Issue podcast. I'm now taking it. But no.
I'm just going to send Yosra stuff that I want to happen so she says it out loud.
Yeah.
No, it's brilliant, and I cannot wait to see what he does next. He's made 2 of my favourite films of the past decade, and he's only made 3 films, and it's like, I can't wait to see what he does. I think Moonlight is fantastic. I'm really glad you both really liked it as well, because it's just, to me, it's brilliant.
I can't imagine anyone not liking it.
I do know somebody, a friend of mine who's also really into film, who didn't really care for it that much, and I kind of understood where he was coming from. I think he just didn't really feel anything from it, which to me was quite a surprise, because I felt everything from it. I don't know, it's subjective, isn't it? So I do know a couple of people that didn't take away the same things that I took away from the film. I think he still said, even though he didn't like it, he still appreciated the filmmaking and the storytelling. So, you know, it's one of those.
Fair enough, but I hope he's in therapy.
What surprises me about that is I actually think it is really in a cinephile's wheelhouse. It's basically... It's made for the Cambridge Arts Picture House, isn't it? It's not made for a multiplex.
That's where I saw it, funnily enough.
It's not Black Panther, do you know what I mean? Black Panther is the film with the almost entirely black cast that made a shitload of money. This is something quite small, quite indie, quite artsy. I'm surprised that I would have thought it would be in a cinephile's wheelhouse.
I think it is for the most part. I mean, you can't watch it and not appreciate the filmmaking. It is a film for film lovers, but it's also a film that, you know, my family, for example, they saw it. They're not as big into film as I am, and they loved it. You know, I went to the cinema with my friend who doesn't normally go and see films, and she was like, wow, that was special. I remember her saying that was special. So I'm glad that it does kind of translate to people who might, you know, not normally kind of see these kinds of films. I don't know, but it's just a very special film to me, and that's part of the reason why I picked it, although, as you know, I had a great struggle with it.
But we have got a way of sorting that out, but more on that in a bit. I just want to, because we are Standard Issue, just talk about the women. Obviously we mentioned Naomi Harris, but Teresa, played by Janelle Monáe, is also a great character.
Yeah,
because of the nature of the story that is being told, there's not many strong roles for women within it, but the two that are there are absolutely crucial.
Yeah, and I think hats off to Janelle Monáe. I mean, I'm gonna praise her for whatever she does, because she is literally my favorite human in the whole wide world. Cannot tell you how much I love her, but that role was brilliant for her, and there's a real warmth that you get from her as that character in both the first part, where she tries to get Little to talk, and there's a real warmth just emanating off of her, and then again in the Chiron sequence, the middle sequence, where, you know, Juan's sadly not there anymore, I don't know, every time she was on screen, there was a real warmth that I got from the character. And it just, I think it suited Janelle Monáe really well. It was a brilliantly written character.
It's interesting because we basically know nothing about her. We don't know why this woman hasn't got children of her own. We don't really know what's happened to Juan. We don't, it's just, but yet she feels like she has depth.
Yeah.
Or someone we know nothing about.
Yeah.
Like, or next to nothing about. The only thing we know about her is how she interacts with this little boy that just gets dropped on her, basically, one afternoon.
I mean, I'm going to say, you chose an absolute hit. Everyone loved it.
Yay! Yay! I'm so happy. I'm really, especially because, you know, the first time you watched it, Hannah, was on a plane. You've not seen it before, Mickey, so I'm really glad that you liked it. The team.
Hello there, listener. Jen here to ask you a little favour, if I may. If you're not doing so already, you can follow us on all of the social medias. Well, not all of them, because we're old and we don't know what all of them do. But on Twitter, we are at Standard Issue UK. On Facebook, we are Standard Issue Magazine. And on Instagram, where it would be particularly helpful if you would follow us, we are at Standard Issue Podcast. Also on Twitter, you will find me at InspireGen, Mickey at Mixter Noonan, and Hannah at That Dunleavy. Ah, go on, give us a follow.
So, because we have all struggled to choose an actual favourite because we're not sociopaths who only watches the same film over and over again, we've decided to keep this going, which means we all get to choose another favourite, in inverted commas, film. Hooray! So, it is the turn once more of Indie Queen Dunleavy.
Well, I'm struggling. I am definitely struggling with this because I would almost certainly have picked Brokeback Mountain as my next favorite film, but I feel like we're stepping in a very sort of similar area than this week, so I might put that on hold and we can talk about that at another time, which leaves me in a situation that I suddenly thought, I don't know what the fuck to pick, because I had until I watched Moonlight again yesterday, and then I realized how similar it was in many ways thematically in the sort of thing I would say about it.
There's a definite Venn diagram to be drawn there.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hannah.
That's quite all right. So I had a bit of a confusion about what I was going to pick. So I've narrowed it down to three films. The Philadelphia Story. We haven't watched a black and white film, and I absolutely adore. Or Terrence Malick's Badlands, which again, I absolutely adore.
Or a little squeak from your there.
Or Almost Famous, which I also absolutely adore. So I was wondering which one of those you guys hadn't seen, and we could go from there.
That's not how this works. You've just got to pick one, Hannah. Sorry, I'm not taking any responsibility from you. You've got
to influence the decision, especially because I feel partly guilty that you couldn't choose Brokeback Mountain, so I'm not going to influence this.
It's all yours.
Go on, let's go for Badlands then. See, although I haven't seen it for a while. I haven't seen Badlands for a while. So
is it like 12 hours long?
For about 5 years. So apologies if it is massively long and you have to sit through it and you hate it, or there's something like wildly inappropriate that I didn't notice was in it before now. But yes, let's watch that.
Brilliant.
That sounds good, because I've actually not seen it. So the reason I gave a little squeak when you said it was because it's one of those films that I've always wanted to see, but just never seen. So it'll be good.
What's amazing about Badlands is the first time you watch it, you'll go, I know that music, because that the music from, I won't be able to tell you what it is now, but when you hear it, the music from Badlands has been picked up and used in tons and tons and tons of other stuff. So it has an odd feeling of familiarity, even if you've never seen it before. I do love some Terrence Malick.
We're going to wrap this up now so that we can all find time in our diary to watch a Terrence Malick film. And but before we go, I want to know, Yotara, have you been to the cinema yet?
No, I have not. My local, Cambridge Arts Picture House, is opening its doors from tomorrow. I'm still a bit unsure about it all. I don't know if you have both thought about going to the cinema, but I'm still a bit like, I don't know.
I'm just not sure.
I want to support the cinemas, especially, you know, my local, and I want to support them, but I'm still feeling a bit funny about it. So, not yet.
Especially the Arts Picture House. We stood in the street with a banner to stop the Arts Picture House closing down. I now feel morally obliged. Not you and I, but we were both there, but we weren't together when we went and held a banner in the street. But yeah, I can't quite get through myself to do it yet.
Yeah, it's a shame. Like, it's you know, I've got friends that work there, so I really do want to go, but I just haven't mustered up the kind of, I don't know if it's courage is the right word, but just in terms of, I don't know.
Maybe we'll see. If it's this hot again tomorrow, then the sweet, sweet air conditioning will sway you.
Yeah,
32 degrees tomorrow. I mean, I'm going to need to be somewhere cool, so.
Yeah. You know what, though? If you do decide to go, St. Francis is excellent.
Everybody's told me to see that, actually.
Yeah.
That is something that maybe I will consider.
Yeah, it's really good.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, I love this. It's great. I get to talk about films for ages.
Standard Issue for all women.